Do we have a new treatment for osteoporosis?
Does Tylenol used during pregnancy increase the risk of behavioral problems in kids?
Has flu mist been vindicated?
And beta blocker use after stents may not be a good idea.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on August 19th, 2016. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, and dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I'd like to turn right to Annals of Internal Medicine. Gosh, we've recently talked about these Hutterites, these poor people. They've moved into isolation. Now everyone wants to study them. This was a look at the efficacy of the flu mist, the nasally administered flu vaccine versus the intramuscular administrated vaccine. And hey, we've panned flu mist, but now we might be picking it again.
When you give a vaccination, you do two things. One is you try to prevent the individual who gets the vaccination from getting whatever the infection is. But secondly, there's also what's called community or herd immunity as well. That is, when we immunize children and prevent them from getting influenza, it lowers the risk of the community, the adults in that same community, getting the infection as well. Previous studies have suggested that this nasal administration of the vaccine, which you call flu mist, is more effective in kids than giving the inactivated vaccine via a shot. Does that really lower the risk of influenza in the community? And what better way to study this than the Hutterites? These are populations of about 70 to 120 residents that live in single-family dwellings. They communally share buildings, kitchen, dining halls, and schools. They're relatively isolated. So what this study did was they randomized the children in these communities to receive either the intranasal live attenuated virus or the intramuscular inactive virus. And they've looked at the incidence of flu in the community. What they discovered was that the influenza virus infection rate was about 5.3% in the group that received the live attenuated virus, the flu mist, and 5.2% in the community that received the inactivated virus. So essentially, there was no difference.
Well, as you know, we, I think, mentioned recently that the flu mist was panned as an effective means of protecting people against the flu. So this study, at least to me, seems to vindicate this as a method of immunizing.
Previous studies suggested that it was 55% more effective in children than the intramuscular injection. So, Elizabeth, you're right. Although the CDC Advisory Panel on Immunization Practices initially recommended it for kids in 2014, subsequent studies have shown that it loses its effectiveness. As a result, it's no longer recommended in kids, even though as many as a third of children were immunized that way previously.
Yeah, and I know kids say that they prefer to have a squirt in the nose versus a shot in the arm. I will say that my own personal experience with flu mist was really pretty terrible. I didn't like it at all, having that stuff dripping down the back of my throat. But this Hutterite thing says, okay, maybe it is okay to use the flu mist.
Well, for the community, it offered no advantage over the intramuscular injections. And what the studies would suggest is that in individual children, the flu mist loses its effectiveness over time.
Maybe an ongoing controversy. Then let's turn from here to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Osteoporosis, of course, a major problem, especially in women as they age, but also in older men. Now, a new drug for that.
I was unaware that as many as 50% of women 50 years and older will have a fracture before they die. Now, most of them are vertebral fractures, kind of a shortening of the vertebrae that's relatively asymptomatic. It's relatively painless. But some go on to have hip fractures as well. So in individuals that are at high risk for having fracture or osteoporosis, the recommendation is to use medications that either prevent the bone from resorbing or medications that actually can add bone. Now, it makes sense that by decreasing your resorption, you only get so much bang for the buck. What you'd like to do is begin to lay new bone down. The medicines that do that are those that interact with a parathyroid hormone receptor. There's one out on the market. This study tested a new one. It compared it to placebo and the older medication, the newer medication being called abaloparatide, and it was compared to placebo or to the other one that's on the market, teriparatide. They followed these women for up to a year and a half. What they discovered was that the new medication lowered the risk of fracture by about 86%. It increased bone mineral density more than placebo and even more than the drug that's currently on the market. So, Elizabeth, this is good news. This adds another medication, a second in class for this particular type of drug that shows it's effective in preventing vertebral fractures and in increasing bone density.
I think it is good news, especially because so many of the other either previous drugs or even calcium supplements for that matter, A, aren't really all that great, and B, are associated with other conditions that can be problematic.
And for that reason, women have avoided using the medication to prevent some of those side effects. Now, in fairness, there are side effects associated with these medications as well, although they're relatively minor, that can occur in somewhere between 7 to 10% of women. The other thing that needs to be mentioned is these are administered via injection, a subcutaneous injection. But again, they're clearly effective.
Okay. We'll be watching, of course, as they roll these things out and seeing what kind of things turn up when thousands of people are taking them over time. Let's now turn to JAMA Pediatrics, an association. So I beat you to the punch there, Rick. I knew you were going to say that. An association between acetaminophen or Tylenol use and behavioral problems in childhood.
The reason I introduce it as Tylenol, although it is really acetaminophen, is because that's what many people know it by and is commonly thought to be safe to be used during pregnancy. So for women that have musculoskeletal issues or minor fever, it's recommended that they take this as opposed to other medications. But this study would suggest that its use during pregnancy is associated with behavioral problems in childhood. And it was based upon a longitudinal study called the Avon Longitudinal Study of Parents and Children. It's a prospective birth cohort in which almost 8,000 mothers were enrolled between 1991 and 1992. And the children were followed up till about 5 years of age. They assessed acetaminophen use in the mothers during pregnancy, during primarily the second and third trimester of pregnancy. They assessed it after the children were born, and they looked at the partner's use of acetaminophen. And what they discovered was the use of acetaminophen by the mothers during the second and third trimester of pregnancy was associated with an increased risk of the children having hyperactivity symptoms and emotional symptoms. It increased them by about 20 to 30%. The use after the child was born was not associated with these, nor was use of acetaminophen in the partners.
We've already pointed out that this is clearly an association, although I believe the authors did identify a reasonable hypothesis for why this might be the case.
Absolutely. Brain formation continues throughout the second and third trimester of pregnancy and is associated with hormonal status in the fetus. We also know that acetaminophen crosses the placenta and the baby can make some of the toxic metabolites. It also affects oxidative stress. So there is biologic plausibility.
Simply speaking from my personal experience and having taken acetaminophen while pregnant, I'm just wondering, gosh, if we're not going to let pregnant women take acetaminophen, then what else is possible?
Elizabeth, that's a great question. Obviously, I'm going to ask the women who are pregnant to interact with their physicians. But what I'd say is what we're probably better off is avoiding medications when possible, unless it's absolutely necessary.
No doubt we're going to try to identify more specifically what goes on with acetaminophen during pregnancy. Finally, then, let's turn to the one that really spoke to your heart directly as a cardiologist, and that is something that seems to pan beta blocker use in a large group of patients. That's in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology, Cardiovascular Intervention.
And you're right, both as a cardiologist and because the senior author is from Texas Tech, but more importantly, because this affects millions of individuals, and it's the use of beta blockers, a medication that's routinely given to people that have coronary artery disease. And it's been shown to be effective in people that have had heart failure. Old studies suggest it was beneficial in people that have had a heart attack, but many individuals receive it prior to having a stent placed and remain on it afterwards. So what Dr. Mukherjee did was he looked at over 750,000 individuals in the United States who had received a stent. They did not have heart failure. They didn't have a heart attack. And he followed them over the course of about 3 years and compared them, by the way, to individuals that weren't placed on a beta blocker. And those that were on a beta blocker, it did not lower their risk of heart attack, stroke, death. It didn't even lower their risk of needing another revascularization. In fact, what it did do was just increase the risk of having heart failure in the future. So this suggests that a routine practice of giving beta blockers after a stent is probably not useful and may in fact be harmful.
Good news, of course, for people who don't have to take more medicines.
Absolutely. And they also tracked the use of beta blockers over the last 8 years, and they have clearly been going up in this patient population. This suggests to me that the guidelines need to be revised.
Talk to me about increasing use of beta blockers. What do you attribute that to?
Their use is clearly effective in people that have heart failure. Old studies suggest that they may be useful after a myocardial infarction, although that was in an old era. I just think it's one of these things that has been around for a long period of time. The guidelines recommended it. Nobody's really looked at the evidence very carefully, and so the use continues. We've discussed the fact that a lot of our payment now is based upon, are you following the guidelines, whether the guidelines are really evidence-based or not.
What other potential clinical situations would you say beta blocker use needs to be more carefully examined in?
In certain patient populations, and particularly the elderly, the complication rate may be very high. Things like insomnia or increased depression. We have other medications that may be more effective with lower complication rates. So that's the other patient population we need to look at that in.
No doubt we'll see that study at some point. I'm going to talk about FluMist, or the intranasal flu vaccine, this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.